This is an ABC podcast.
I'm Jonathan Green. This is Lost and Found, and this week, Venice. Henry James, Italian Hours. It's a great pleasure to write the word, but I'm not sure there's not a certain impudence in pretending to add anything to it. Venice has been painted and described many thousands of times, and of all the cities of the world, it is the easiest to visit without going there. Open the first book and you'll find a rhapsody about it. Step into the first picture dealers and you'll find three or four high-coloured views of it. There's notoriously nothing more to be said on the subject. Everyone has been there, and everyone has brought back a collection of photographs. There is as little mystery about the Grand Canal as about our local thoroughfare, and the name of St. Mark is as familiar as the postman's ring. It is not forbidden, however, to speak of familiar things, and I hold that for the true Venice lover, Venice is always in order. There's nothing new to be said about her, certainly, but the old is better than any novelty. Juliana Engberg is a curator, author of En Route. And Juliana, it's no coincidence that we're off to Venice.
None whatsoever, Jonathan.
you are curating the Australian contribution to the VS Biennale, work by Angelica Massetti.
Yes, a fantastic project. I can't reveal too much about it.
No, but it's don't going give away to be, the surprise.
No, but it's going to be absolutely fabulous. And if anyone knows anything about Angelica's work, they will know that it's going to be rich and metaphoric and have a lovely sense of poetry and musicality and performance about it.
And one needs no excuse, I guess, to go to Venice, but there's a fine one.
Well, if you must go. No, you never need an excuse to go to Venice. It's a sublime city.
Take us there. And your tour of that sublime and somewhat difficult to navigate
the city. The Serenissima of Venezia. I think we should start at the market, okay. A very good place to start. Early in the morning, as the bells peal, and we see that have that lovely sense of Venice coming to life. It's a maritime city, so it keeps to the sort of hours of the maritime ethos, up early. Down a little bit early as well, unless, of course, you're a carouser or with the Carnavale. But let's start at the fish market.
Locate that for us.
It's just near the Rialto Bridge. On the other side, people would think of the kind of retail side, but let's go on the other side where it's less about, you know, shopping.
Just follow your nose.
Follow your nose. You can't help but feel that briny, smell that fishy kind of atmosphere as you get there. I think when you look at all that fish, you know you're situated on an island in the water, and it makes a lot of sense because the Venetian cuisine is incredibly based around fish.
Beginning in the markets too gives us that sense, which is often elusive in Venice, of a place in which people actually live.
Where people actually go, and so it's a good reason to go early because all the nonnas are there. You know, picking up the choice fish, not the ones with the dull eyes. They're actually looking for the, you know, the absolute best kind of one. And you know, they're regulars, habitués, so they get the perfect pick. It's also a great place for a coffee because the guys who are setting up the market, they want a nice strong brew to get them sturdy and steady for the rest of the day. So I think after we've had a little peruse of the fish and, of course, the vegetables that go with the fish, we should sit down and have a little espresso and cogitate what we're going to do next.
Plan our next move. Colin Bissett.
The best way to arrive in Venice is by boat, like Aschenbach in Death in Venice, but a close second is by rail. You don't expect trains in Venice, but its station is one of the most theatrical in the world. Your train takes you across the lagoon on a viaduct that was built in 1846 to serve the first Santa Lucia station, which was replaced by the current building. The great stations of Italy are often statement pieces. Milan's is overblown and monumental. Florence's is 1930s rationalism, and Rome's is all 1950s glass modernism. So it's a surprise to find that Venice's is like many others around Italy, polished travertine pillars, tiled floors, and a ticket hall graced with a jaunty mosaic. But then you step outside. It's as energising as discovering the Grand Canyon there, because beyond the shallow steps and the open piazza is the Grand Canal itself. This is the business end, though, not the bit Canaletto painted, but all the same, it's filled with life. The vaporettos churning the water, the water taxis, and the crowds of tourists lugging their bags across the bridge and into the city proper. A domed church and the faded grandeur of medieval buildings face you on the opposite side of the canal. You expect singing at the very least, but there's usually the sound of bells. Before you leave, turn around and take in the station building. It's long and low so that it doesn't intrude on the skyline. The winged emblem of the railway company crowns the plain facade, the only decoration. The building was planned in the 1930s by Virgilio Vallo, who was happy to do whatever Mussolini wanted. And Mussolini wanted modern stations. This one now handles over 30 million passengers a year. In fact, the building wasn't completed until 1952, slightly modified by Paul Perilli, but retaining the fascist signature stripped classical look that is hard not to admire despite the politics behind it. As a plain and simple gateway, it allows you a moment to gather yourself before succumbing to the theatricality and riches of the city before you.
So, brim in hand from the market, Juliana.
I think we need to put it in a fridge.
Where will we go?
Look, I'm not going to take you where people normally go. That's, you know, San Marco and all of those places, because I think they're pretty well trod and well known in some ways. I'm inclined to take us on to Castello. Again, a very authentic part of Venice where people really live, where the washing is still up on the lines and you see children playing on the streets with their soccer balls and things of this sort. And I think we might just nip into a most extraordinary bookshop.
Oh,
yes.
Splendid.
The bookshop Acqua Alto. This you have got to see, Jonathan. You will be astonished.
Because?
Well, you have to be careful because it is really as if the whole tempest has kind of tipped down and the deluge has happened. There is not a single nook and cranny that is not book-filled in this wondrous place. It is just like an installation. I mean, artists would try to effect such an appearance, but in fact, they have simply just gathered over many, many decades all of the ephemeral books and bits and bobs. They're stacked in gondolas. They're in the walls. They're holding up the ceiling. Not exactly Dewey Decimal, and you've got to go carefully. I think we, if we're lucky, we might find an old secondhand copy of Henry James, because of course James was a fantastic Venetian. He loved Venice. He was inclined toward the sort of lugubrious, sad side of it. But I would love to be able to share with you the Aspern papers, because it's a wonderful novella, which I think evokes that whole dilapidated, you know, lost grandeur sense of Venice, which I think James was so particularly great at evoking. And I'm sure that we'll find it here somewhere if we can just...
Will the staff be able to help? Can they, in fact,
no.
in this...
I'm afraid you're on your own, like a gondola without a paddle up the canal. Yeah.
Stefano De Peri is the chef behind Stefano's Cantina in Mildura, Victoria. This music we're hearing, Stefano, tell me about that.
This is a song by Reinaldo Hahn called La Barchetta. It's written in the Venetian dialect. He's one of many composers who compose in a classical fashion folk songs, or they took folk songs and remodeled them to a more elegant, if you like, style.
There's a lot of music around Venice.
Well, you can say that, you can say quite legitimately that a lot of music was born in Venice. I mean, take Monteverdi, the father of, by now, the great-great-great-grandfather of opera. Everybody knows Vivaldi, but there was a terrific tradition. Someone has written a convincing book, which I can't quote because my memory is not that good, arguing that almost anyone in Venice in the 17th, 18th century could sing or play an instrument. There were hundreds of theatres and, of course, there was a strong musical tradition in the church with great organists. But everybody knows Vivaldi, for instance.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
And many operas subsequently were launched from the trampoline of La Fenice, the famous opera house. You know, a lot of Verdi's operas were first performed there and then launched to the world. Rossini was at home in Venice. My God, the list goes on and on.
It's a place of confluence. Music and food too, of course. And you, we want to jump from Vivaldi to cuttlefish, which is...
Look, you asked me for a recipe.
Yes.
And I thought we will honour the discovery of the black hole. Or rather, not the discovery so much, the photograph.
That's rather right.
Because they've known about it for a long time.
Risotto al nero.
Al nero, yes. A black hole, a black risotto, which is a very, very simple thing if you can get hold of some calamari or cuttlefish. Better still, our Victorian waters can produce a lot of beautiful calamari, particularly around the Gippsland Lakes out there. I've been able to buy them from normal fish shops. If you are patient, you can get the sack out of the tube, but otherwise go to a specialist shop and get some either a jar of ink or some sachets. And all you have to do is chop it up, cook up a little bit of garlic, and once the garlic is taken some color, throw it in, splash of white wine. Well, there are many variations. Some people like to add tomato to extend the sauce, and then finally you put in this ink, as much as you like, as much as you have, as much as you can find, whatever. But it has to be dark, otherwise it's not convincing.
What stock will you use with that?
No stock.
No stock?
You just braise it. You got the oil, you got the garlic, some parsley, of course, a little bit of chili, that doesn't go astray either. And you can, once you've got this sauce, and you can cut the cuttlefish or the calamari in either small or large pieces, take your fancy. This kind of cooking is very much basic cooking for that everyday people just do. And mothers didn't have time to, you know, pretty up the squid. They just chop it up, chuck it in, off you go. You know, it's got to be tasty. Make sure you put some salt, but careful because... it's already, you start off with a fairly salty base. And you can finish it with spaghetti, which is the traditional thing, but you can also serve it with white polenta, which I prefer.
Venetian food obviously draws from the sea.
Yeah, a big deal. I mean, most of it is, there are two parts to it. Of course, the Venetians had their back to the mainland until the fall of Constantinople. And then they turned to the mainland because they began losing all their lands and influence over Greece, the Mediterranean, of course, Turkey. And as they retreated to the mainland, their diet expanded to things that are typical of the terra firma, the land, not the sea. So beans, and then with the discovery, after the discovery of America, of course, maize came in and became a staple because very easy to produce in the northern plains where there's plenty of water, or there used to be, and a beautiful summer, and that gave them that staple polenta. But on the islands of the Venetian lagoon, you find some very fertile places, so they grew everything for the island itself, especially beautiful things like radicchio or artichokes. So you can say that the integration of the mainland with the tradition of the sea made Venetian cooking quite special and quite particular.
Why in particular, in what way?
In the sense that sometimes here we can't replicate it. You can't find some of the things that are typical of the Venetian lagoon. Mm. The Mediterranean Sea or the Adriatic Sea is quite shallow. So there's a lot of small fish, but very sweet and very particular. We draw most of our fish from the ocean, and it tends to be bigger, It has a different texture and so on. But Australia, coincidentally, has got something in common with Venice in the sense that Australia, in different parts of the continent, can produce almost every single fish or crustacean that's typical of the Mediterranean. Mussels, different type of octopus. Fact is that we have been a bit snooty over the years, and we've always discarded fish that wasn't whiting, that wasn't prawns, that wasn't, you know, premium.
Spoiled,
that's right. Spoiled, but then we limited the range of, and we should expand it greatly. There's room for that.
The Venice of the Southern Hemisphere.
Yes, indeed.
Stefano, thank you.
Thank you to you.
Stefano De Pieri.
Peggy Guggenheim was art. Her uncle Solomon had already amassed a great collection that would be housed in Frank Lloyd Wright's gleaming white museum in Manhattan when Peggy began immersing herself in the cultural scene of 1920s Paris. She even married two surrealist painters in succession, one of whom being Max Ernst. And she took abstract art to the world, starting with her gallery in London. She famously bought a picture a day for her own collection, including everyone from Brancusi to Picasso. She made sure everyone knew who Kandinsky was, and then, back in America during World War II, she gave Jackson Pollock his first show, supporting him throughout his career. In 1947, she bought the Palazzo Venier dei Leoni in Venice, in which she lived until her death in 1979. It's one of the most unusual buildings in the city. Facing the busiest stretch of the Grand Canal, not far from the Salute Church, you might mistake it for a modernist interpretation of a Venetian palace, being so white, so low, so odd. But look at the monumental Palazzo Conaro on the opposite side of the Grand Canal, and you'll see the sort of place it was intended to be, only grander. The Veniers were one of the city's most venerated families, producing three doges, including one painted by Titian. Work started on the palace in 1751, but almost immediately stopped. No one quite knows why. The ground floor languished in its wonderful setting until recovered by the Marchesa Luisa Caserta in 1910, who reinstated its grand rooms, hosted somewhat ludicrous parties for the likes of the Ballet Russe, and had a flock of albino blackbirds whose feathers she dyed according to her mood. Another socialite owned it afterwards, before Peggy Guggenheim got her hands on it in 1947. In 1951, she flung open its doors to the public, allowing everyone to enjoy her remarkable collection of works by the greatest 20th century artists, which positively drip from its walls. Peggy herself is interred in its beautiful garden, overlooked by statues by Marini and Kapoor. It's an enchanting spot to sit and reflect, but better yet is to steal away from the crowds and stand on the waterside steps, gazing out at the Grand Canal. Here you can appreciate how this was always meant to be the doorstep to a magical world, almost as surreal as some of the works it now displays.
Giuliana, we have fish, we have books. What must we do next?
We need heaven, don't we?
I think
we need a heavenly place. And look, a lot of people, of course, when they go to Venice, gravitate immediately to the Basilica San Marco, that marvellous place of loot and, you know, a grand statement of, you know, Venice's conquering.
Some of history's greatest loot.
It's full of, you know, kind of plundered stuff. Tremendous, though, it is. I think since we're over here in Castello, we should actually go to San Giovanni e Paolo. It is a brilliant church, gorgeously located on on the canal. One of the reasons, I suspect, for the reason that it is a popular choice with brides and grooms, because they can glide up and come up the stairs and look very, you know, festive and festooned in all their twill and so forth. But it is actually a really remarkable church. Inside, you find some of the astonishing artists of Venice, Bellini and so forth. But in particular, I would love to draw your attention to the ceilings of Veronese.
Uh-huh.
Because here you have this magnificent trompe-l'oeil heavenly space that is created, no longer a distance perspective, but a perspective that takes us seemingly up through the clouds, beyond the clouds, to, you know, that spot. So I just think it is a beautiful church that evokes certainly a time in which people believed very much in the transport of heaven. And I can well imagine the congregation looking up and thinking, I'm going to be taken away, taken to my, you know, resting place through this magnificence, which is, you know, framed so carefully by him, and the architectural surroundings that give you this astonishing sense of trick of the eye.
To sit in those places and imagine that older imagination looking at those things,
well,
and seeing the theatre of that work.
It would be like a miracle.
Yeah.
These were astonishing visual feats that were being created at this time. And you can well imagine when they first started to see the capacity to produce these heavenly ceilings, that the congregation would have gone, oh, my God.
Your phone won't do it justice.
Never. You have to stand there, because the atmosphere that it's created is quite remarkable, actually.
The Giudecca is the island tucked to the side of Venice, and people visit its great buildings like Palladio's Redentore Church and various 19th century villas, or they luxuriate in grand hotels like the Cipriani. But the island has long been a place of workshops, boatyards and warehouses. Many of these buildings remain, often repurposed as cultural spaces. There was always a population living here, the workers for the area, which is why it's worth tearing yourself away from the main sights and taking a moment to walk along the quiet and often surprisingly leafy laneways of the Giudecca. It's here, for instance, in the Campo di Marta, that you'll find social housing by Aldo Rossi, the architect and theorist who won the Pritzker in 1990. Rossi's seminal work, The Architecture of the City, stressed the importance of cultural context, the way that our buildings reflect how we think of ourselves. His own buildings have a curious familiarity, all light and shade, like a De Chirico painting, with elements that evoke other eras. Tucked away next to the island's market garden, this cluster of pale terracotta low-rise apartment buildings, built in 1984, is topped by arched metal roofs that recall the dome of the nearby Redentore Church, as well as buildings by the early modernist architect Adolf Loos. The solidity is broken up by brick staircase towers that evoke Renaissance fortifications. And while you're here, take a stroll to the western part of the island to inspect a larger complex, designed in 1980 by Gino Valle, with 94 apartments tucked into an area bounded by narrow canals and abandoned factories. These finely shaped brick buildings evoke industrial warehouses and the ostentatious neo-Gothic flour mill nearby, now an equally glitzy hotel. Seemingly crammed together, the long apartment blocks contain covered arcades, crisp staircases and stolen glimpses that draw you onwards and reference the narrow alleyways of the old city itself. The tall canal frontages have stylized gables sliced in two, like ruined classical pediments. These social housing projects may not be the equal of the grand palazzi and churches nearby, but they show how good design and livability remain an important part of this, the most extraordinary city on Earth.
You've been listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production, this week on Venice. You heard Stefano De Pieri's chef at Stefano's Cantina in Mildura, Victoria, Juliana Engberg, curator and author of En Route, and Colin Bessett, design writer. Producers are Mira Adligillis and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Matthew Sigley. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.